Welcome to Home and Family Finance with Paul Barry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is sponsored by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and by CUNA, the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Barry.
And I'm going to begin this program on a note that I want you're going to hear often here. On every show, the question that we ask, are you financially fit? Are you financially fit? No, don't look to the side. I'm asking you to take stock of your situation. Are you financially fit? Do you even know how to be financially fit? Do you know what it means? This program is entirely based on financial literacy, on educating you about being the best consumer you can possibly be, that you can make the right decisions about your home, your family, and your finances. But the question comes up, and if you can believe this, there is a question, and it just seems so unnecessary, but it is absolutely necessary. Should we teach financial literacy in school? Didn't you think that was already being taught? Until you go back and review your history, and then you realize the difference between what you learned in school and what's actually out there in the marketplace, and you realize that you didn't learn, and you didn't demand that you had to learn that your children learn it. 87% of Americans say financial literacy should be taught in schools. No kidding. This is what an RBC Wealth Management and City National Bank poll found out recently. Is financial literacy an important enough skill that it should be taught alongside reading, writing, and arithmetic? Yes. Most Americans seem to think so, according to a recent survey from RBC Wealth Management, U.S. and City National Bank. And so does my guest, who looked at this, who commissioned this and looked at it. Malia Hoskins is Vice President, Wealth Strategist at RBC Wealth Management, U.S. Money has long been considered a taboo topic, even among families, she says. Does it make any sense? Malia, first of all, and let me get your name right. I think there are so many ways to say it, but Malia Hoskins, let me tell you, is a vice president and wealth strategist for RBC Wealth Management based in Minneapolis. She's been with the company since 2004. Not only is she a strategist when it comes to wealth, she's also a licensed attorney. So I think she knows what she's talking about. And this, why did you commission this survey?
As a wealth management firm, our advisors often find themselves working with the children of our clients to ensure that those children have an understanding of money and wealth. And it's a conversation that many parents aren't comfortable having themselves. We conducted the survey to gain a better understanding of how the various generations of Americans have learned, or didn't learn, to your point,
right,
about money and basic financial concepts, and how they, in turn, feel the next generation should learn about money.
And the truth of the matter is, Malia, that if I don't learn, how do I teach my child? You can't prepare your child to manage their own money if you've never learned how to do it yourself.
You know, that's an excellent point, and I think, you know, our statistics bear that out. It appears that, the baby boomers feel like that they didn't receive adequate instruction about money from their parents, compared to 29% of millennials said that they learned about money from their parents, whereas, the statistic was that 10% of the baby boomers felt like they learned about money from their parents. So we're getting better at it,
yeah.
But you're right. As a whole, if the parent group itself is not educated, then how can they be expected then to educate their kids?
And why is it a taboo topic? Why are we afraid or reluctant, or we will not talk to money with our children in the family? Why?
You know, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is just a hangover, I think, from maybe the parents of the baby boomers. They really felt like money was the responsibility of the parent and not necessarily that of the child. And so it was just something that parents took care of and didn't really feel that it was appropriate to bring the kids into the conversation. That's, I think, obviously changing. But I think that hangover is still there.
Yeah.
Plus, I think it parents feel then they have to maybe share some of their failures, which is
yes,
oftentimes
yes,
awkward for them to do.
I think you're right. I think because in many cases we're struggling to make ends meet, and it may not be comfortable to to discuss among ourselves, parent to parent. We certainly are not going to bring the child into that discussion because we're not going to, and it's not a matter of admitting failure. It's just that we're not doing as well as we want to do. So we kind of keep it among ourselves. And I think that's part of it as well. That makes sense, I think.
I agree. Yeah. No, I agree with you.
But don't you think that the school would be jumping? Look, we play educational roulette. Malia, we give them a little bit of health, a little bit of science, a little bit of this or that, because in case they want to be a doctor. But the one thing that we know every child coming out of school is going to be, the one thing we know they're going to be is a consumer. And yet we fail to prepare them adequately. I don't get it.
I think what was surprising about the survey results to me was that, you know, while we're still not great at it, we are getting better.
Okay.
The respondents in the survey in all age ranges, from baby boomers, the Gen Xers, and the millennials, they are still primarily self-taught on the subject, and parents are still shouldering the responsibility of educating the kids. But you're right, it's at a time when the investment options and the financial products that are available are vast, and they're much more complex than ever before.
Yeah, they are. And, of course, one of the interesting things I want to talk to you when we come to the next segment here is that this new technology, I mean the social media and the equipment that we have now may be pressing us, pushing us toward that as well. My guest is Malia Haskins from RBC Wealth Management. We're talking about their survey. And, folks, surprisingly or not, yeah, financial literacy should be taught in schools. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
We want you to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about. Or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
My guest is Malia Haskins, who is wealth strategist with RBC Wealth Management. We're talking about a survey the company did that found that most Americans, most people feel that financial literacy is important enough to be taught in schools. So we're finding, why isn't it taught? The one thing that we know that everybody graduating is going to be is a consumer. Why don't we teach them how to balance a checkbook? What investment tools are all about? I know that among many things, looking at your bio here, there are an array of estate planning strategies, everything that you could think of, and you know all about that. But I dare say most of the people you come in contact for the first time have no clue about these things. Is that a fair statement?
It's interesting. I think I see a broad spectrum of folks. I would say you're right. The majority of our client base has not been, you know, educated
right.
with regard to the more complex financial literacy matters.
Yeah, I guess if you don't learn the basics, you're not going to learn the complex levels. That just doesn't work that way, does it?
You're right. Without that foundation to build on, it's really difficult because, you know, the more complex strategies
yeah.
often, you know, do build off from those, I guess, more basic concepts. But, you know, over the past several decades, I think Americans in general have just been assuming more personal responsibility for their financial literacy in an environment where we've got choices that are much more complex. So, you know, what I mean by that is that financial products are more prolific and more complex. We've
mm-hmm.
got 529s, mm-hmm. 401ks, mutual funds, alternative
right.
investments.
Right.
And additionally, financing options are also more complex. We've got options like credit cards, mortgages, home equity loans, asset-backed lines of credit.
Oh.
But the means of educating these individuals about these particular options, to your point, really has not kept up with the demand.
Well, and what about the high-tech stuff that the kids now use? Is this helpful, Malia, in terms of young people or anybody learning more about finances, or is it a hindrance?
It's a benefit overall.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, I think more people, young people in particular, we're seeing that, you know, millennials are becoming much more educated and financially literate
mm-hmm.
than the older generations who maybe don't have as haven't had as much exposure to the financial, or I mean to the social media and other websites. But with that broad array of social media,
mm-hmm.
there is opportunity for, you know, false information or maybe,
right.
You know, incorrect information to be out there as well. So, you know, if I think that's where working with a professional, a financial advisor, to help navigate what is, what is, accurate and true, and help, help.
I hear you. A certified.
Wade through all of those things.
A certified financial analyst, help counselor is important all the time. I note that on your website, RBC, you have a financial literacy and generation gap. Give us the – where do people go to – because this is available to them. And it's, and I read through it, and it's good stuff in there. Where should they go to pick this up?
RBC U.S. or Wealth Management U.S. has created a financial literacy resource center, and it's on our website. And it's available to clients, but it's also more robust through our advisors. So – if client, individuals can partner up with one of our financial advisors, they can have access, and the Financial Literacy Resource Center is available to them. And it's a, you're right, it's a great website. It includes various educational materials and worksheets. We've got a really nice program. It's 7 Ways to Raise Money Savvy Kids, and it's designed for parents, for children that are 17 and younger, as well as for adults that adult children that are in their 20s. And we address 7 key ways to raise those money savvy kids: budgeting, earning, saving, spending, giving, borrowing, and investing. And there are worksheets and methodologies and recommendations for parents with regard to coaching kids around all of those topics.
Tell us again how we get there. How do we get to that, to find that?
It's on RBC Wealth Management website. And I'm sorry, I don't have the...
They can find it. If they're interested, they'll find it. And thank you, by the way, for being with me here and also for doing this study. It just more fuel that says we got to do it the right way. And come back and see us again soon, would you?
I would love to do that. Thanks so much, Paul.
It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. Coming up next, how much should you tip? And should you tip the Uber driver? This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry. This is Financially Fit with Paul Berry. Are you? You're listening to Radio America, and I'm your host, and we thank you for joining us. Our program sponsor is the Defense Credit Union Council, and we thank them for their continued support of the program dedicated to making all of us smarter consumers. If there's a topic or subject that you want to discuss, please write to me here, Paul Berry at Radio America, 1100 North Glebe Road, Suite 900, Arlington, Virginia, 22201. And if writing is not your thing, and for many of us, we'd rather do it on the web or the net, our website is www.hffradio.com. Okay? We'd like to hear from you. We'd love to hear from you. The Defense Credit Union Council and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of Military Saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our troops. Military Saves is a year-round campaign that seeks to motivate, support, and encourage military families to save money, to reduce debt, and to build wealth. So important. As part of the Department of Defense's financial readiness campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. Check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management and can find partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. Military Saves. Set a goal, make a plan, save automatically. And go to militarysaves.org for more information and take the Savers Pledge today. And of course, whether you are or are not in the military, you ought to be saving. And I suggest to you, and I suggest a minimum of 5% of what you make every month. Put it aside. Pay yourself. You'll be thankful and happy that you've done that. Okay? Now, as you all know, it is summertime and vacation time for many of us. And that's usually also something that comes up along with that, because we're in new places, we're doing new things, we're meeting new people, or maybe it's just our old routine. But no matter where we are, tipping comes into the game. How much do I tip? Who do I tip? Who do I not tip? When do I not tip? Am I a deadbeat if I don't pay somebody because I think they've given me bad service? And by the way, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I'm told that TIPS, T-I-P, stands for to ensure promptness. That's what TIP is about, to ensure you're tipping somebody because you want good service. Nobody knows whether that's true or not more than Miriam Cross. She is personal finance editor for Kiplinger's, and she joins us now as a follow-up to her article on this very topic. Hello, Miriam.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm great. How are you?
I'm good.
What do you think? Do I deserve a tip for having you on and giving you a chance to talk about your headlines and your topic? Yeah. Okay.
Not a tip, but thank you.
Okay. Well, see, and that's exactly the point. There. When do I tip and when do I not? Is there any hard fast rules here, or how does that work?
Well, you generally want to tip service people who rely on tips to make a good living wage. You know, professionals such as lawyers and doctors, you would never tip them, but restaurant staff, you know, drivers, tour guides, people who work at a hotel, these are all people who rely on tips to, you know, boost up their salary.
How about my hairdresser or my barber? Do I tip them?
Yep, those two.
So they fall under. So anybody that provides a service to you and counts on an addendum to their income is who you would look to tip, right?
That's a good general definition.
Okay. All right. Here. And you raise the question. Here comes the pool attendant with that fresh towel you asked for. You're having a great, relaxing vacation, and all of a sudden you tense up. Because the guy's coming in. He's nice. Got a great smile. You like him. I'm or she. And do I say thank you and move on? Come on, Marion. What do I do here?
Well, in the case of a pool attendant, it's $1 per towel.
A dollar per towel. I'm going to be there for 2 weeks. Miriam, I just went bust every time that guy's okay, but you're right. If I'm coming out, it would be like 4 or 5 or 6 days. $7 would cost me. But if they bring a towel, give them a tip, right?
That's true. But, you know, just a good general tip for this whole subject is if you feel like you're getting gouged on gratuities, then you can also just sort of skirt those services that would require tipping, you know, bring your own towel, then you kind of avoid the whole issue.
Okay, but the guy cleans off, or at least pulls out one of those seats for me and comes over and looks after me. So am I obliged at some point to say, okay, here's a buck or two for your time?
Yeah, in that case, yes.
Okay, so you do. So what you seem to be suggesting here is to just use good sense in terms of who deserves a tip and who does not, or when you should be thinking of giving somebody a tip.
That's a good way to think about it, because it also varies a lot between countries.
Okay.
So our quiz has some guidelines, and then you also want to use your own judgment. You know, if they gave you great service, then you want to tip a little more.
All right, when we come back, we'll talk more about that. My guest, Miriam Cross from Kiplinger. Do you tip? To tip or not to tip? That is the issue.
Helping you be safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Berry.
My guest is Miriam Cross. She is the personal finance editor for Kiplinger's. As you head off to your vacation, wherever you may be going, and I hope you're lucky enough and fortunate enough to have time to get away with the kids or by yourself or whatever, but no matter where you go, you're going to run into service. People are going to give you service. And if they give you service, what do you give them in return? Well, we call them tips to ensure promptness, T-I-P-S. Mm-hmm. All right, Miriam, first of all, is that true? Is that what that stands for, tip?
It depends on the situation. I mean, sometimes, and you also probably don't want to think about it that way. You want to think about it more like showing gratitude for people taking care of you and providing good service.
Okay, all right, so not just prompt service, but somebody that's really looking after you. Okay, let's talk. We're doing our trip. We're having fun. We're being well looked after by someone. And is there a measure of what? How much do I tip? Is there a percentage amount? Is it how much money I make? Is it how much money I can afford to do? Is what I can steal from the kids? I mean, what? How do I make that choice?
Well, in the travel world, a lot of the subjects we covered usually tip by dollar amount. So it's usually a few dollars per bag or per room night or per service. Sometimes it's by percentage, though it's also a little bit up to your judgment. If you received really great service, you may want to tack on a little bit extra. If you received really poor service, then you may want to give a little bit less as long as you still give something and maybe speak to the manager just to express your displeasure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Now, here's let me develop a scene for us, okay? Follow me.
Okay.
I pull up to the Mayflower Hotel, right? And out comes the door, the car guy, the whatever he is at the south side. And he, great, Mr. Barry, Miss Miriam, nice to have you guys here. And he opens the door and he grabs our bags and he puts them on one of those little bellhop things, one of those rollers, right, on the curb. Mm-hmm. And there at the curb is the bellhop who's taking this thing from the driver, from the doorman. And he takes you inside the hotel. And inside the hotel, you check in, and then either that bellhop or another takes you up to your room. Now, I've just encountered 1, 2, 3 people at the minimum. Which one do I tip? Do I tip all three? Do I give one guy the money? How do I handle that?
That's pretty tricky. So I would say the bellhop who did the most work, the one who took your bags, brought them inside, got you settled, you'd want to give them a couple dollars for your first bag, maybe another dollar for your second. If the taxi driver helped you unload your bags, then just tack a little bit on to the tip you give them, maybe a dollar per bag.
Okay, so I'm tipping the taxi driver. What about the doorman at the hotel? Am I giving him anything for taking my bags from the taxi driver and putting them in on the cart?
The doorman, if the bellhop is the one kind of doing most of the heavy lifting there, then you can just tip them. The doorman, you would generally tip if they've done like an extra service for you, such as hailing you a cab.
Okay, but if they're just helping my bags out of the car, I don't have to tip him.
I mean, you certainly can if you want to show your gratitude. But if it's just a really quick thing and someone else is doing most of the heavy lifting, then, you know, then it's up to you.
Okay. Miriam, you're not being helpful here with me. Okay. Because, I mean, I'm feeling guilty. I'm looking this guy in the eye. He's grabbed the bags from the taxi driver. He's put them on the thing. And Mr. Barry, Miss Cross, nice to have you with us. And in we go. Do I just leave them? You know, it feels... Okay, here's my question. Should I be uncomfortable at all in all of this?
I mean, ideally, I think it's inevitable. We all feel uncomfortable because we just don't know sometimes. So if you do and they've been really helpful, then by all means, give them $1 or $2.
Okay. So just if you feel the urge, do it, right?
Yeah, most of the time. I mean, there's some situations where you definitely are expected to. Other times it's more up to your judgment and how you feel.
Okay. Now, what about my Uber driver? My Uber driver or whoever, does my Uber driver get a tip? I mean, we don't exchange money because it's all done by credit card or whatever. And he gets me, picks us up on time and gets us to the, do I tip that person?
I always tip my Uber drivers.
Do you?
I do.
Don't they say not to tip them?
That's a big misconception. They don't say not to tip them. You can't tip them through the app, but they are certainly allowed to take tips. You just have to be sure you have some cash on you.
Okay, so they expect a little something, 10%, 15%, or what?
I tend to give a dollar or two per ride, depending on how long it is.
Okay,
it's not a kind of a set expectation the way taxis are. So there's not really a rule yet, but that's how much I do.
Okay, and we're talking here with Miriam Cross, personal finance editor with Kiplinger. Let's go inside the restaurant. We've had a great meal. Comes to a couple $100 for the four of us or whatever. Okay, Miriam, what's the standard amount of money? 10%, 15%, 20%? What am I being ridiculous?
Well, in the U.S., the norm is about 18% nowadays. 15% is still okay, but it's really moved up to 18%. And you'd want to tip more, say 20%, if they've provided really good service.
Okay. All right. And finally, I bought a $150 bottle of wine during dinner. Okay, do I tip on that 15% of that, or 18%, or 20% of that $150 bottle of wine?
Include that in your bill.
Yeah,
so include that on the amount in your bill.
Yeah, but I am. But I'm saying, do I tip that with that? My bill goes from $200 to $350. Do I give 20% on that, or 20% on $200?
I mean, in that case, if it seems like too much, I would actually abstain from getting such an expensive bottle of wine.
Okay. All right, Miriam. That is what a dodge. I love that. I really enjoy having you on the show. Thanks for being with us. Come back again, would you please?
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Sounds good.
All right, have a great day. Miriam Cross. I don't have to answer that. Just don't buy a bottle of wine, you fool, and save money. When we come back, a very serious topic. Do you know what HIV stands for? Do you know what AIDS stands for? Yeah, you should. We'll be right back.
We want you to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about. Or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Barry.
Folks, I want to get real serious with you for a minute here as we talk about the next topic. Monday, June 27th. Monday, June 27th is National HIV Testing Day. Monday, June 27th. Do you have any idea what HIV means? Yeah, I know you associate it with AIDS or with homosexuals or with something used to be and all of that. Well, it's not just used to be. Let me tell you. Let me give you a number here. More than 1.2 million, that's million Americans, are living with HIV. But according to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, 1 in 8 does not know they are infected with the disease, and only 3 in 10 controlling their virus with treatment. Now, that's a shocking statistic. 1.2 million Americans of us are out there living with AIDS, and 1 in 8 of us have no idea. You know, this is important. And why is it important on the show about financial fitness? Is because dollars. It costs money to treat you. If you find out, you're going to have to pay a lot of money. And if you don't know about it and you're suffering from other things that are associated with it, it's costing you money right now. And I'm going to – my next guest knows all of that. He is with us. Glenn Pietradoni is Senior Director of Virology. Glenn, help me with that. What's that? How do you say that?
Virology, the study of viruses. Yes.
Okay. Listen, Glenn, thank you. I mean, let me be dumb about some things. Okay, I didn't know about that. But you're certainly aware of it. You're Walgreens Senior Director of Virology and is a lifelong resident of the Chicago area where he has been an active member of the HIV/AIDS community. After graduating from the St. Louis College of Pharmacy, Glenn co-owned multiple independent pharmacies in Chicago and its suburbs for 10 years. He began his career with Walgreens in 1990, around the time of the approval of the first HIV/AIDS drugs. Why is Walgreens involved with this, Glenn?
You know, we've been involved since the beginning of the epidemic, even before there were drugs. People were infected, you may remember, in the mid-80s or late 80s, and there was not a whole lot that we can do to help people, except we were, you know, providing vitamins and nutritional support, emotional support, but there wasn't really much that we could do. And once the drugs were starting to be approved in the late 80s, a pharmacist is a perfect person to interact with people that were impacted by the disease, and we wanted to make sure people took their medicine correctly. Now, admittedly, we didn't know as much as we know today in those days, so we were trusting the drugs would work. And as we went along in those years, we learned along the way, and so now we know a lot more, and we could help people in so many ways.
Absolutely, and thank you, first of all, for being on the show as well. Let me just say that. I'm just listening, looking through this, and what I was very troubled by in terms of my awareness that I didn't realize that we have a date for that, which I'm glad that we do. And secondly, I also looked at your information, and I noted that HIV says that. It doesn't say what that is, and AIDS, AIDS, it doesn't say what that is. I guess we've gotten comfortable with the terms because they reflect, and we knew what that was years ago. But just to make sure our audience is aware of what we're talking about, tell us what HIV is and why it is so dangerous to some.
So HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, is a virus that is exchanged through blood and bodily fluids. And it is a specific type of virus that's very difficult to control. It's not something that we have a cure for today, but we do have many, many medications that help suppress the replication of the virus. So in other words, you are somebody that has contracted HIV, you have the virus in your system, and we use medications today to stop the replication, but we don't yet have a way to eradicate the virus entirely from the body.
Okay, and AIDS, which is the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, is the worst part of it. It gets to that point, and that can be deadly. Is that a fair statement? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so HIV is the virus, and then the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome are the bodily changes that happen. So your body is less able to fight off infection, and it becomes prone to infections and complications when the HIV virus is not controlled.
Okay, and we do know that 1.2 million Americans or thereabout are living with HIV. Is this life-threatening to them or no?
So what is life-threatening is not knowing your status and also not being in care. So if you're somebody that is unaware of your HIV status, the best thing you could do is get tested. And once you know the status of your blood and your immune system, if you're negative, you could learn and protect yourself at how to stay negative.
Mm-hmm.
If you're positive, it's critical to get into care. And we're finding today that with the medications and the treatments and the knowledge our doctors have and our providers have, we could completely control this virus, and people living with HIV could live a near normal lifespan.
Okay, but one in eight doesn't know they are infected, according to the statistics.
That's right, one in eight. That number is getting a little bit better over time. We are making improvements. But it's the people that don't know they're infected. They are the ones at risk of spreading the disease. The ones that are aware of their infection and are not in care are also probably more at risk for spreading the disease. It's the people that are in care, they know their status, they're being seen by a provider, they're adherent to medications. Those people can do very, very well.
Okay, so testing is the key here for those folks. And what's involved in the testing? What's involved? Is it costly, and what do you have to do to test?
So in our activation of our National Testing Day events around the country, we're offering free testing at our stores, over 220 stores around the country. And those testing hours at Walgreens are Thursday, June 23rd from 3 to 7, Friday, June 24th from 3 to 7, and Saturday, June 25th from 10 a.m. till 2 p.m. And those tests are free.
Okay. Hold on just a minute. Let me take a break here. When I come back, we'll talk more about the testing and how you qualify and what you need to do. My guest is someone who knows all that you need to know. So when we come back, Glenn will talk more about this. This is Home and Family Finance. You're listening to Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry, here on the Radio America Network. Thanks so much for being with us. My guest is Glenn Pietradoni. He is a senior director at Walgreens in terms of testing and the effort that they put forth in terms of helping you identify whether or not you are one of those who happens to be HIV positive. One out of every eight persons of the 1.2 million that they know that are infected don't know it, and it could be you. So, Glenn, if that's the case, how do I start the process? Do I just walk in? And I know not every Walgreens is doing this, so run through that for me, would you please?
Right. So we've partnered with over 150 AIDS service organizations and health departments around the country to offer free testing at Walgreens, and 220 Walgreens locations across the country will be participating in a three-day testing event where people can receive a free HIV test. And in order to find the location nearest you that's offering the free testing on June 23rd, 24th, and 25th, mm-hmm. there's a website, www.greaterthan.org/Walgreens. www.greaterthan.org/Walgreens. And you could look up for the closest Walgreens doing this testing near you.
And what does the testing consist of, Glenn?
Well, different testing organizations use different methods. In some locations, there's an oral swab that is rubbed throughout your gum line and around your mouth, and that test takes about 20 minutes, and you can get within 20 minutes a preliminary response if you're preliminarily positive or not. And if it is preliminarily positive, what that means is the test needs to be confirmed by a secondary provider. Mm-hmm. So we'll send you to a secondary place to get that confirmation.
Okay.
Other locations may use a finger stick test where they take a drop of blood to do the same type of test.
Okay. Those hurt.
Well, it's a very small little finger prick, yeah. And it's very similar to what you'd get if you were testing your blood sugars or other types of things.
Absolutely. And that's why I asked the question. Folks, this doesn't hurt you to do this. And the results can mean so much to you. So if you haven't been tested or even and you're not sure, be sure. Don't be one of the ones, some 8 million folks that don't know. That just doesn't make sense. Is testing anonymous, and how quickly will someone get a test result?
So the testing results would be within a few minutes, actually, depending on which test it is. You could either get a test with the finger prick in a minute or two, and the oral swabs are around 20 minutes. And these tests are confidential, and you would come into the pharmacy where we have a private location set up and completely free of stigma, where you could ask your questions, you could learn about HIV, you could learn about what you might do if you're negative and how to stay negative, and if you are positive, we can educate you and link you to the right care that you'll need.
Okay. Does someone need to make an advance appointment, or can you just walk in?
It's just a walk-in, again, for these 3 days. And, we also, beyond this testing day and the testing day events, you could literally go into any pharmacy and pick up an over-the-counter test kit with the oral swab. Those are sold in most pharmacies around the country, including every Walgreens pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, you could search on the web or find other locations that do free testing all year round. That's something that you usually can find in most communities around the country.
And if I find out that I'm HIV positive, what then happens? What happens? Is there counseling? What happens, Glenn?
So obviously we want to get you into care. It's better when you have a care provided by somebody that's educated in HIV and an expert in HIV because they've been experienced. They know how to help you. As I said, we have medications now that are relatively simple and free of side effects, and they're just we've come a long way in the treatment of HIV. The goal, again, is to get the virus down to undetectable levels so that you can live a high quality of life and live a near normal lifespan.
And somebody's out there now saying, like, okay, but why would I think I would be HIV positive? Why would I think that? Is there any signs or symptoms that I should look out for?
Well, of course, there's signs of HIV infection, and they may be very similar to what you might feel if you were had a flu or a cold or something.
Okay.
So you wouldn't necessarily identify it immediately. But what I can say is that there are so many resources out there and people that could help. We need to get everybody to know their status. The government says everybody should be tested for HIV.
Well, Glenn, thank you. Thank Walgreens. We really appreciate this. And thanks for taking time to be on the show and give us this heads up. Glenn Pietradoni, Senior Director of Virology at Walgreens. Folks, look, do yourself a favor. Go to Greater Than AIDS and find out. Glenn, come back and see us again soon, would you?
Thank you.
You bet. Radio America is the way you get to us, and we'll see you next week, same time, same place. I'm Paul Berry. Thanks so much for being with us.